Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 241. A little bit loud. Turn it down a little bit. So, Bible 241, this is October 11th. Okay, everybody will stop talking because I can always turn up my microphone even really, really loud. Okay. But that will work. You all can hear me. So, today is October 11th. See if I can get a cursor to that side of the screen. I can. So we're still in nervous system. That's chapter 7. And what I wanted to look at is when is the next test? The next exam is not Tuesday. Ah, that's good. Okay. So it's a week from Tuesday coming up on October 23rd is the second exam. And that's going to include the chapter that we're talking about today. Okay, and then that's it. So the next exam is going to cover chapters 4, 5, and 7. Any questions on the schedule at all? Pretty good. All right, that seems reasonable. In lab this week, you have an extra credit assignment, drawing of an action potential, and we got a chance today to go over it in lecture. So if you have that picture in your mind, that would be really helpful. So let's just start talking about the topic at hand, unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question? I don't see any questions. Oh, that's good. I'm not sure I like questions. So I think that's pretty good, and then all the other lights go off. So we'll leave it like that. All right, so last time we reviewed anatomy quite a bit. We looked at different parts of the nervous system, central versus peripheral nervous system. We looked at efferent pathways versus afferent pathways, and then pathways in between. What's a pathway in between an efferent and an afferent pathway? It's called an association pathway or integration pathway. So an association neurons, and those are found completely within the central nervous system. And what are the two parts of the central nervous system that we're going to be aware of? Brain and spinal cord. Exactly. Okay, and then we started to look at a neuron. We began to look at the different pieces of a neuron. Remember, a neuron can conduct information in one direction only. And what is that direction? It starts, what's the receiving end of a neuron? The dendrite. Good, and then that information flows over the cell body and then into an axon and then all the way down to an axon terminus. So it goes dendrite, cell body, axon in that direction and not the reverse direction. And in this class, you'll learn the reasons why that is. Then we talked about, previously, resting membrane potential. And then we defined some terms by looking at this oscilloscope. Now, I do have a cursor here someplace. Where is it? Not supposed to go away. I saw it. Here it is. Okay, I won't lose it now. Okay, so here is here's a neuron, and we can measure the resting membrane potential by putting one electrode of a two-electrode system inside the cell, and then keeping one outside the cell. We can measure the voltage across the cell membrane. So this is just a fancy voltmeter or an oscilloscope. And it just plots out what a voltage looks like versus time. So this is voltage versus time, and you can see millivolts right here. So it's kind of a small voltage, but it's very easy to measure. And it's easy to make these little recording electrodes that you can place inside of a cell, because if you take some glass tubing and put it in a Bunsen burner, what happens to that glass? It becomes very, very soft. You probably didn't blow any glass at any particular time in your life, but maybe you've seen somebody at a fair do that. You just heat glass up and it gets very almost like a liquid. And then if you pull the glass tubing really fast, it gets really, really thin before it breaks. And as a matter of fact, it's so thin it's microscopic. And then you can, with a microscope, help of a microscope, put the tip of that glass tubing right inside of a cell and fill that glass tubing with a salt solution of some kind, usually potassium, that conducts electricity. Then you have a nice electrode that you can actually put right in the center of a cell. So they're not terribly difficult to make. Okay, and the oscilloscopes are pretty handy. They've been around for a long time. So you can watch voltage versus time on an oscilloscope. And on this one right here, you see that RMP is about what voltage? Yeah, minus 70. So minus on the inside compared to the outside of the cell at 70 millivolts. And then if the resting membrane potential changes, then we're going to say something is happening to RMP. If it moves from a large negative number like minus 70 towards zero, we call that depolarization, and that's an excitatory event. right? If it moves the opposite direction from minus 70 to a bigger voltage, like minus 80, minus 90, we call that hyperpolarization, right? So the voltage is getting bigger, even though it's in a negative sense, and that's an inhibitory signal on the cell. All right, so don't forget that. And when we talk about voltage, it's across the cell membrane. All right, then we learned that there are two kinds of ion channels that we're going to be dealing with in this class. One is a voltage-gated channel, and the other is a ligand-gated channel. A ligand-gated channel can open and close when it binds a signaling molecule. And a voltage-gated channel can go from a closed to an open or from an open to closed state depending on the voltage across the membrane, because these proteins have electrical charges on them. And when you change the electrical charge of their environment, they get pushed and pulled in a little bit different direction, and they can change shape as a result of that. So when the membrane depolarizes, here's a particular channel that opens when it depolarizes, and then after a period of time, as it becomes more positive inside the cell, there's even another little special protein that gets drawn up into the channel and closes it, and we call that an inactivation gate. So even though the channel is open, the inactivation gate can close that channel down for the diffusion of ions across the membrane. And we're going to be considering a couple ions, mostly sodium and potassium, but let's open up a channel in the membrane that allows ions to move through it. All right, which way is sodium going to go? Okay, so where is sodium at a high concentration? On the outside of the cell. So by concentration gradient, it's going to want to diffuse, right? Just diffuse right into the cell. But there's another reason why it wants to enter the cell. What else could you invoke to explain why sodium likes to rush into the cell? Because sodium is a cation. It's a positive charge. And what's the charge on the inside of the cell? Negative. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So the electrical chemical gradient, if you think of the chemical gradient and the electrical gradient, favors the entry of sodium into the cell when this channel opens. All right, so that's kind of where we're going to start with an action potential. All right, so let's look at this graph right here, which is just a nice plot of membrane potential, and potential is a voltage term, versus time. Right, and here we have time in milliseconds, so these are kind of short periods of time. This is something that happens relatively fast. And we can see that before zero, this cell, so we have an electrode inside the cell, outside the cell, this is a plot that we would see on an oscilloscope, for instance, or some kind of chart recorder or something like that. Then we can measure the voltage inside the cell. Before time zero, this means at rest. So here is a resting membrane potential. What could you tell me about the resting membrane potential on this cell? It's what? Yeah, it's minus 70 on the inside compared to the outside. All right, then at time zero, we start to apply a stimulus. And the stimulus we see is what? Depolarizing or hyperpolarizing? Is depolarizing because this number is getting smaller. It's going from minus 70, right, to minus 65, minus 60, minus 55. So this voltage is getting smaller because it's going up towards zero. So that is an excitatory event on the cell membrane or on the cell. It's not inhibitory, so we call that a stimulus. And if we keep that stimulus applied, the membrane potential changes and still drifts up to zero. And then all of a sudden, if that membrane potential reaches minus 50 millivolts, something special happens. Because at this voltage here, there are a number of proteins in the membrane that change conformation because they're getting pulled and tugged in a little bit different direction because the voltage is changing, and these channels open up. And in particular, what we're going to be concerned about in this first phase of an action potential is a sodium channel. So a sodium channel opens up at this particular voltage, right, which we call the threshold voltage. And when sodium channels open up, what happens to sodium? Rushes in a big way, because what? The electrical chemical gradient is drawing it inside the cell. And as we take a positive charge from outside the cell, inject it to the inside of the cell, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Yeah, it becomes neutralized because of all those positive charges entering, so it goes all the way to zero. And as a matter of fact, so much sodium enters the cell that the inside of the cell becomes positive because so much sodium enters in because of the chemical gradient. Okay, so that's the new equilibrium potential for sodium. So this is the first part of an action potential. We have the stimulus. If it reaches threshold, then sodium channels start to open up. Sodium rushes inside the cell, which causes this massive depolarization. So an action potential has two main phases. This first main phase is what we call depolarization due to sodium entering the cell, right, and reversing the charge of the cell. Then right at this period of time, right, when it reaches 30 millivolts, then that inactivation gate closes. Where's that inactivation gate? At positive 30 millivolts, this inactivation gate closes. What happens to the flow of sodium or the diffusion of sodium inside the cell when that happens? It slams closed, right? So there no longer can be any depolarization at this point in time, so indeed the cell stops depolarizing. All right, here's the second part of the story. Right at this time, right when the stimulus reaches threshold, the sodium channels open up. But there's another channel that begins to open up at the exact same time, and it's a potassium channel. But the potassium channels are slow to open up. They start to open up at the exact same time, but because it takes longer for them, they don't really affect the electrical properties of the cell until after this depolarization phase. So the potassium channels start to open up. Okay, and by the time the sodium channels are closed, we have potassium leaking outside of the cell. Now, why does potassium like to leak outside of the cell at this particular point in time? Right here. Because inside of the cell is positive means the outside is negative. So the electrical gradient for potassium is drawing potassium out of the cell. And what about the concentration gradient? Where is potassium low? It's low outside the cell, so sodium just by diffusion is going to move out of the cell as well. And when positive charges leave the inside of the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It repolarizes. It goes back down to negative, right? So it's not too terribly difficult once you analyze this curve. And as a matter of fact, so much potassium leaves the cell that it overshoots the resting membrane potential and hyperpolarizes. So I want you to be aware of this little area right here of hyperpolarization. Hyperpolarization is when excess potassium does what? Excess potassium leaves the cell. That's why it's so important to be able to draw this diagram. So action potential has got two main phases. One is depolarization, which you should be able to relate to as the movement of an ion. What ion is it and which way is it going? It's sodium entering the cell, causing depolarization. The second part of an action potential is repolarization, which is due to what ion? The potassium ion, and which way is it going? It's leaving the cell, right? So when positive charges leave the cell, then the inside of the cell becomes more negative. And as a matter of fact, so much leaves the cell, there's hyperpolarization as well. All right, so sometimes we call that flux of an ion, but remember, when an ion moves, it's really an electrical current because an ion has an electrical charge. So if an electrical charge is moving around, we call that a current. So there are currents, electrical currents, due to these different cations moving across the membrane. All right, so let's take a look at the flow diagram over here. So first we have a depolarizing stimulus. That's sort of an oxymoron because depolarization means what? It means a stimulus. If we were to hyperpolarize from resting membrane potential, if we were to move down this way, follow the cursor, if we were to hyperpolarize the membrane, is it moving toward threshold or farther away? It's moving farther away, that inhibits the cell, because then it has to recover all of that voltage before it can reach stimulus, the threshold voltage, right? So hyperpolarization is inhibitory, depolarization is excitatory on neurons. Okay. Oh, this is what we're talking about. Okay, let's look at this flow diagram. So depolarization and stimulus are almost like synonyms once you understand the mechanism of what's going on, right? So depolarization is always going to be excitatory. Now, when the resting membrane potential reaches threshold, then sodium gates open. Potassium gates start to open at the same time, but they're what? They're too slow to have much of an effect right at that time where the stimulus reaches threshold. Okay, so, and as one sodium channel or one sodium gate opens up, right, then that allows sodium to enter the cell. And what happens to the membrane potential when sodium enters the cell? It depolarizes. And what kind of event is depolarization? It's excitatory, so more sodium gates open, All right, and as more sodium gate opens, what happens to sodium? More sodium enters the cell. And as more sodium enters the cell, what happens to resting membrane potential? It depolarizes even more, even faster. All right, so what does this sound like? When an event causes the potentiation of that same effect. Okay, so when something adds to the stimulus, we call that positive feedback. So here is an example maybe you should remember almost for the rest of your life, of a positive feedback mechanism being normal and absolutely necessary for everyday homeostasis. Okay, so depolarization is maintained by this positive feedback loop. So once it reaches threshold, more sodium diffuses into cell, which causes more depolarization, which opens more gates, which more sodium enters the cell, which causes more depolarization, on and on and on. And then all of a sudden, all the sodium gates are open and the cell just floods with sodium, causing this massive and very rapid depolarization. Okay. And then, right, the potassium gates open up at this point in time, right when the sodium inactivation gate becomes activated, and then the effect of potassium can take over and repolarization takes place. But you should be aware of that nice little positive feedback mechanism that explains why depolarization is so rapid. Okay, and then what stops that positive feedback mechanism from operating? How come the whole world, the whole universe isn't filled up with depolarized cells? Because the inactivation gate closes when the membrane potential becomes positive, and then that whole process gets reset once again. Okay. All right, so that's some of the things you have to know about an action potential. We're going to talk about some more things about an action potential. Now, what kind of membrane proteins are we considering when we think of an action potential? We talked about ligand-gated channels and voltage-gated channels. So in your mind, you got to get that straight. Which kind of channel are we talking about in terms of an action potential here? It's a voltage-gated channel. That's right. It doesn't have anything to do with a ligand. It just all depends on what? The voltage across the membrane. So you do have proteins that are sensitive to voltage. All right, so depolarization and repolarization occur by diffusion. It's just a passive process, which is kind of fascinating. This beast right here, this action potential, is driven just by diffusion, passive properties, right? But the reason why you have sodium high on the outside and potassium high on the inside is because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump. So this unstable condition is generated by that primary active transport pump. So cells are irritable because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump. But the action potential itself does not require any kind of active transport. But then after an action potential, then the sodium-potassium pump resets the cell to get the right concentrations of sodium-potassium on either the inside or the outside of the cell. So ATP is necessary in order for a cell to transmit an action potential or to develop an action potential, but not exactly during this time when an action potential is happening. All right, so why do we call this an action potential? Here is resting membrane potential. It's just a constant. We call this an action potential because something's happening. Voltage is changing. So we call this an action potential. Okay. All right, so the mechanism. We talked about this already. So here we have a couple of graphs, membrane potential versus time. Here is just an action potential, kind of a sloppy diagram because I really don't see a threshold voltage on this diagram, which I definitely want you guys to be aware of. Okay. Oh, as a matter of fact, let me test you on that. Let's go back to this diagram. And here is a stimulus. And right at this time when this lead line, stimulus lead line, reaches this point right here, if we turn the stimulus off, what's going to happen to the cell? It's just going to sit there, right? Then this membrane potential is going to go back down to resting membrane potential, and an action potential will not occur, right? An action potential only occurs if the stimulus reaches threshold. Otherwise, we call that a sub-threshold stimulus, and an action potential won't be triggered at that point in time. Okay, so I don't see that on this diagram. I don't see threshold, but you should always be aware. All right, so this rapid depolarization is caused by sodium diffusing into the cell. Repolarization is caused by diffusion of potassium outside the cell. And even this area here of hyperpolarization is due to excess potassium leaving the cell. Okay, so this just shows us the time period where these different channels are open. So we have two curves. We've got sodium and potassium diffusion versus time. So the top curve is due to both sodium and potassium, but if we were to break this curve into two pieces to show sodium and then potassium, we would see that the sodium channels are open during this period of time. They open up first because they are fast, and then here the inactivation gate closes, right? So then the activity decreases very rapidly. Then the second part of the action potential really develops because of the slow potassium gates that open, and since they're slow to open, they are also slow to close. Okay, and if they're slow to close, that causes this little area of hyperpolarization, which is going to be really important in just a little bit. All right, so those are all things about an action potential. Here are some other important details. If we just look at this curve, we've got a couple of things going on. We're measuring voltage versus time. So this is a voltage versus time plot. And then down here, maybe it looks like a different color, we see these arrows. We see different lengths of arrows underneath. And this represents the stimulus. So first, the first stimulus is what compared to the last stimulus? Okay, the first stimulus is weaker, right, because the arrow is shorter. That's what we're trying to signify. Then the second arrow is a little bit longer, so the stimulus is a little bit stronger. And then the third one is even stronger still. And the fourth stimulus is even a higher amplitude compared to the first stimulus. And so here we apply a stimulus to this cell. And what could you tell me about this stimulus right here, this arrow? What kind of stimulus is that? Yeah, that's sub-threshold. So if we look at this diagram over here, here's a stimulus that maybe reaches this point. It's sub-threshold, and we see that it does not produce an action potential. The stimulus was there, but it's sub-threshold. And so let's increase the stimulus a little bit. We increase the stimulus, maybe put this arrow maybe right here someplace. Maybe not right in the middle of the action potential, but a little bit preceding it. Okay, here is a threshold stimulus. So some sodium channels start to open up, and that depolarizes the cell. That causes more sodium channels to open up, which depolarizes the cell even more. And then all of a sudden, all the sodium channels are open. That causes this rapid depolarization to that positive feedback mechanism. At this point in time, the activation gate slams closed. The potassium channels are now open, and repolarization takes place. We let the cell recover during this period of time, and we come with a stronger stimulus, right? A stronger stimulus reaches threshold, and now I see two action potentials. What about the amplitude? The amplitude is the height of the action potential. What can you tell me about the height of this first action potential compared to the second? There's a little grid right here, I think, on my screen that I can just barely see. It's what? Exactly the same height. What about the width of this action potential? You might need to bring out some calipers or something, but it's exactly the same. So what can you tell me about a threshold stimulus compared to a supra-threshold stimulus? It produces exactly the same action potential. So even though the amplitude of the stimulus is changing, the amplitude and the duration of the action potential does not change. And even if we come along with a super strong stimulus, so now the amplitude of the stimulus is very strong, what about the amplitude of an action potential? Exactly the same. What about the width? Exactly the same. So what can you tell me about all action potentials, even though the stimulus amplitude changes? What can you tell me about action potentials? They're all the same. They're all the same. That sounds really boring. How on earth could it be that all action potentials are the same? Because this is the signal that our brain works on. This is the language of our brain. So if we were to listen to an action potential, it would just sound like a blip. Okay, just a very small impulse, and the amplitude doesn't change. But in your everyday experience, can you experience different gradations of amplitude of stimuli? Okay, we could do a quick experiment. Can you see a difference in amplitude of this? What happened? It got brighter. Now it got a little bit dimmer. I'm going to turn some of these other lights off. All right. So you can experience change in amplitude, signal intensity, or stimulus intensity. How is that possible if every action potential that reaches your brain is exactly the same? So we got to explain that. All right, but first, the take-home message is, and you're going to be I'm going to try to trick you all kinds of different ways with end-of-chapter questions and online questions. And what can you tell me about action potentials? They're always going to be the same. There's no change in amplitude, no change in duration. So don't be tricked by any kind of tricky questions. Action potential is an action potential is an action potential, no matter what you do to the stimulus, right? But it is possible for you to understand and appreciate changes of intensity, right? So there's got to be something special going on there. This is how it's accomplished. Maybe I can make the point. Maybe you'll have to see me during my office hours, but I'll give it a shot, okay? So here we have a plot of membrane potential versus time, and I can see some blips on this screen right here. This is an action potential that just has been shrunk down in time, so it's just a vertical line. We can't really see the shape of the curve, but this is just an action potential. What about the second action potential? What does it look like? It looks like the first one. And what about the third one? Looks like the second one and the first one, because all action potentials are what? Very good. They're exactly the same. Okay. So let's turn on a stimulus. So the second trace down here is a stimulus. We turn it on and turn it off, and do we get any action potentials? How on earth can you explain that? Here's a stimulus that's not producing an action potential. Does that make sense? Yeah, because it's a sub-threshold stimulus. It didn't depolarize the membrane to threshold. It didn't open any sodium channels, so an action potential didn't start. So let's turn up the voltage a little bit on this little stimulator that we have. Okay, and it's just right to threshold. So we turn it right up to threshold. That produces an action potential, but we don't turn the stimulus off, we leave it on this whole time. Why is it that we don't have another action potential right here? Okay, or right here? Because the stimulus is on, and it caused the action potential the first time, right at this time. Why is it causing another action potential here and here and here? Okay, because the stimulus is constant, right? It's just at a constant amplitude, but what can you tell me about the membrane potential, okay, right after this repolarization phase? It hyperpolarizes, it goes below resting membrane potential, so what was a threshold stimulus at rest is no longer a threshold stimulus during this period of hyperpolarization. You would have to add this level of excitation plus this level of excitation to cause another action potential. All right, so the cell recovers, it slowly recovers, and it goes back up to resting membrane potential, and when it does, all of a sudden, this stimulus now becomes threshold because the resting membrane potential is drifting back up to RMP. So this area underneath the curve is this hyperpolarization. We call this a refractory period. It's a relative refractory period. That just means that another stimulus could come along during this period of time and cause an action potential if it was what? Threshold compared to this plus what is ever necessary to overcome this distance of hyperpolarization. Okay? So we call it a relative refractory period. It quiets the nerve down, okay, but it can be overcome if you have a super strong stimulus. Let's see if we can see that on this diagram. Okay, so now we got our third stimulus, and the third stimulus is stronger than the second. And now what can you tell me about these action potentials here? What, same amplitude. What about the duration? Hard to tell, but it's the same duration. All right, but now the period of time is the same, from on to off for stimulus number two, on to off for stimulus number three, but what about the number of action potentials? All right, it's a lot higher. The frequency of action potentials increases as the stimulus strength increases. The amplitude doesn't, the duration of an action potential doesn't, but the frequency of action potentials reaching the brain changes as the stimulus intensity changes. And we call that frequency coding. Okay, how stimulus intensity is coded, we call that frequency coding. Just the increased number of action potentials reaching the brain. So with the lights down really dim, that occipital lobe, your primary visual cortex with dim lights is going to hear these little blips coming from your eye, just a blip, blip, blip. But if somebody shines a flashlight in your eyes, what is your brain going to experience? Blip, 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 blip. Right? It's going to be really, really fast, but the action potentials are going to be exactly the same, just a much higher frequency of them. All right, so that's how your brain interprets a difference in intensity, even though every single action potential is exactly the same. So that's one fascinating thing about action potentials. I'll try to mention some more things about them. All right, so here's a graph of what we talked about already. Here is the threshold voltage, sort of the stimulus voltage. And this stimulus voltage, when the cell is at resting membrane potential, is not enough to reach threshold when the cell is in a relative refractory period, because it will only get to this region right here, which is not at threshold, so the nerve will be quiet. It's in a relative refractory period. Unless we come along with a greater than threshold stimulus at this point in time, and then it could trigger another action potential right here, and that would be what? That would be increasing the frequency of action potentials over time with a stronger stimulus. Okay, who's got a question about an action potential? I think I said everything I wanted to say about that. Maybe I didn't. If I can remember something I forgot, I'll go back, talk about it. Why action potentials are always the same? Okay. And that's because right at this point in time right here, it can't depolarize any faster or any more because the inactivation gate closes. So the inactivation gate is always going to close when the cell becomes positive on the inside compared to the outside of the cell. So all action potentials are the same because of this little trapdoor that just closes right here. Boom. Action potential cannot change amplitude because of this little extra protein. We call that the inactivation gate. It always closes at the top of the action potential. I don't know if I really want to give you a number because that number might change a little bit from one cell type to another cell type. But if we were to measure an action potential in the cell, it would be right at this area here that the gate just slams closed. Yeah, okay. And different conditions in different cells will maybe change the exact voltage. But it's going to be when the cell is completely depolarized. Okay, so that's the importance of that relative refractory period. All right, so this action potential is due to what kind of channels, once again? Voltage-gated channels, right, in the cell membrane. These voltage-gated channels, I remembered something else important about an action potential. These voltage-gated channels are found in neurons only along axons, not cell bodies and not dendrites. Okay, so an action potential is a physiologic event that's used to what? Receive signals or send signals? Because an axon is responsible for what? For sending. Yeah, so action potentials are sending information down an axon because axons have what kind of channels, once again? Voltage-gated channels, right. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some different kinds of properties of cells. We're going to measure a membrane potential in a cell. So we're going to put an electrode inside the cell, keep one electrode outside the cell, and measure the membrane potential across the membrane. And we see it's at minus 70 right here. What can you tell me about that cell? It's alive. It's at rest. It's not doing anything. It's just at RMP. Okay, and then let's inject a little signal by injecting some positive current or positivity inside the cell that's going to cause, what, depolarization. And this right here is not a plot of voltage versus time. This is a plot of voltage versus distance from where we initiated that stimulus. So here we have an axon, or maybe a dendrite, and we stimulate the dendrite here, and that electrical signal is going to just move due to these electrical currents through the cell. Okay, and so as it moves from this location to this location over here, what happens to the amplitude? It's decreasing. And then if we move further away from this point of stimulation, what happens to it? It decreases even more, and then it decreases, and then it finally just dies away as we move away from this location. All right, so what kind of activity is this? Could this be an action potential? Absolutely not, because what can you tell me about action potentials? They're always the same, same amplitude. This is a different kind of electrical event. We call this a graded potential. It's a graded potential because it can be big at some times, and it could be smaller at other times. And as a matter of fact, as you move away from the site of excitation, the signal dies away. Kind of like maybe when you tap a bell, it's loud right when you tap it, and then it kind of fades away. Okay? So graded potentials are not due to voltage-gated channels, right? And they're totally different because they can have different amplitudes, right? And the other thing is that as you move away from the site of excitation, they decrease in amplitude, which is what you would expect. However, if we have an action potential here, let's just change our mind and change the slide in our mind, okay? If we have an action potential on an axon at this location, and that action potential starts to move down an axon and it gets way over here, what can you tell me about the action potential on this end of the axon compared to the beginning part? The distal part will have exactly the same action potential in terms of duration and amplitude as the action potential at this proximal end of the axon. All right, so that's fascinating. There's no analog to that in any kind of electrical engineering circuit. Like if we're a transmitter, TV transmitter on Mount Wilson, and we transmit a signal, what happens to that signal by the time it reaches your TV set? It goes down. We put a signal into a wire, what happens as that signal goes through a wire? It decreases as things move. If we want to communicate with the moon, what kind of signal do we have to shoot at the moon? A big signal, because by the time it gets to the moon, right, the signal is going away. All right? Biology has evolved so that action potentials can move through neurons without degradation. So that's important to know. Action potentials move through an axon without degradation. Graded potentials do what? They propagate with degradation, like most things do in the real world. Okay, now wires could work like that we use for transmitting power or signals in our neighborhood, could work like an action potential if we were to energize them with batteries everywhere, if we were to power them, right? Because an axon has, what does an axon have everywhere? That has sodium and potassium pumps that require ATP. So that's kind of the beauty of action potentials, or the trade-off, is that it costs energy to make something propagate signals without decrement from one end of a neuron to another using an action potential. So it costs us something, but it's really nice to have that ability to do that. Okay, so this is a graded potential because the amplitude is decreasing as it travels over, right, some biological tissue. And what else do I want to say about that? Well, because the inside of the cell has ions in it, then it can transmit this electrical signal, right? And it travels at the speed of light. It's very, very fast, but it dies away over time because there is resistance inside the cell to that electrical current. Some of that electrical current can leak out of a cell membrane. And as it leaks out, then the amplitude of this graded potential decreases. All right, so graded potentials, here's another contrast I want you to make. Graded potentials are due to ligand-gated channels, not voltage-gated channels. All right, so what does a voltage-gated channel produce? Action potentials. Ligand-gated channels produce graded potentials. And we find ligand-gated channels on dendrites and the cell body. We typically, in at least the basic understanding of neurology, we don't find ligand-gated channels on axons. Maybe a couple of special cases we get to talk about in this class. But I think for your understanding, you just want to say ligand-gated channels are found on dendrites and the cell body. Voltage-gated channels are found on axons. Okay. So in order to open up a ligand-gated channel, what has to happen? A receptor has to be bound to its ligand, or maybe its neurotransmitter. So a neurotransmitter would be an example of a ligand. So that's why the dendrite and cell body are the receiving ends of a neuron, and an axon is a sending end, because ligand-gated channels require the binding of some kind of signaling molecule that it's receiving from another cell, right? So dendrites are the receiving end of a cell. All right, let's look at an unmyelinated axon. And so we said an axon contains voltage-gated channels, right? And the dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels. Ligand-gated channels can produce graded potentials, so there is electrical activity that can flow from the tip of this dendrite all over the cell body down to this first part of an axon. What do we call this first part of an axon? Wasn't so important when you started looking at anatomy, but it's going to be hugely important in physiology. That's called the axon hillock. And it kind of reminds me of something that I use to put oil in my car. It looks like a funnel, okay, because it's really broad right here, and then it gets a little bit narrow. And I want you to think of the Ecton Hillock as a funnel. Have you ever used a funnel for something? Yeah, when you wanted to pour something into a small orifice without spilling all over the place. So this funnel right here, or Ecton Hillock, is funneling what? Funneling all of this electrical activity from the dendrites and cell body, namely graded potentials, into this first part of the axon. So it's funneling all of that information into this area right here. So you got ligand-gated channels here in the axon hillock. All of a sudden, the cell now knows to put voltage-gated channels. All right? And if all those graded potentials funnel into this area, and it reaches threshold, graded potentials can summate. They can add to each other. Right, and if they summate to reach threshold, what's going to happen with this axon? It's going to cause an action potential here, and that action potential is going to move down the cell because that causes a massive depolarization as sodium enters. Then the next part of the axon, right, reaches threshold, which then causes, due to positive feedback, depolarization. And when this area of the axon depolarizes, because this area here has voltage-gated channels, right, then there's going to be positive feedback right here, opening up a huge number of sodium channels, and this area is going to depolarize, so that wave of depolarization is going to move down the axon from the axon hillock down to the axon terminus because of voltage-gated channels, which we kind of analyzed already. Okay, and we call this a nerve impulse. A nerve impulse is an action potential that got instituted on an axon and is moving down an axon. Nerve impulse is an action potential in motion down an axon. Now, what did we say about the transmission of information over a neuron? Is it bidirectional or unidirectional? It only goes in one direction. How come an action potential can't go backwards? You should know some of the reasons why that is. Because what happens at the tail end of an action potential? It goes into a refractory period. Right, so now you have this part. So now, after depolarization, you have a refractory period. If we excite this area, it can't go backwards because now the axon is in a refractory period on its proximal end. It's only the distal end over here that you only need a threshold stimulus to excite the neuron. So action potentials only can move in one direction because of refractory period. That's why it's so important to know everything about that action potential. Okay. Let me just read this slide. Let's see what I'm talking about here. Oh, there's another important point. Okay, if this is a non-myelinated axon, then there has to be a voltage-gated channel here, and then right here at a microscopic level, and then another one here, and another one here, and another one here, and another one here. And in order for that action potential to move down the axon, guess what? Each one of these channels has to open up at the proper time. So it's got to open up here, and here, and here, and here. We call that continuous conduction. Continuous conduction is really slow if it's a non-myelinated fiber. So every micron of the membrane has to depolarize due to voltage-gated channels. That's a slow form of conduction of a nerve impulse, right? An action potential moving down an axon is a nerve impulse. But we know that in mammalian systems or mammalian nerves, most of them are myelinated. Okay, where would you see this kind of axon right here? Okay, I kind of see something because of the shape of this support cell. What kind of cell does that look like? That looks like a Schwann cell. So where is this axon located? Peripheral nervous system, okay? But there's myelination in the central nervous system is due to oligodendrocytes. It's going to have the basic same kind of form, but not quite the same structure as what we see on this slide. All right, well, let's take a look and see what's happening here. Underneath the Schwann cell, there are no voltage-gated channels. Okay, and it acts as insulation, so electricity cannot leak out of this axon during these locations like it can under these circumstances, right? So a graded potential underneath the Schwann cell is maintained for a longer period of time as it's moving because there can't be any leakage of current, right? But there also are no voltage-gated channels in this area. There are only voltage-gated channels in this particular location. What do we call this location? Or this location? Or this location? Or this location? That's a node of Ranvier. Node of Ranvier has voltage-gated channels, right? And what can you tell me about a voltage-gated channel once it reaches threshold? It's going to open up. It's going to allow a lot of sodium to enter the cell. It's going to cause a massive depolarization right here. right, which sets up a graded potential underneath the cell, underneath the Schwann cell, and it's going to slowly die away, but it's not going to quite die away below threshold before it reaches the next node of Ranvier. And when a threshold stimulus reaches this next node of Ranvier, what's going to happen if it's a threshold stimulus? It's going to cause an action potential here. Causes a massive depolarization, and then another graded potential moving at the speed of light, basically, through this medium, right? Reaches this node of Ranvier, and if it's at a threshold voltage, it hasn't died away completely, what happens at this node of Ranvier? Another action potential. So when we have a myelinated neuron, an action potential doesn't move by continuous conduction, molecule by molecule or protein by protein. It does what? It skips. It jumps from one node of Ranvier and then speed of light, then to the next node of Ranvier, then by speed of light down to the next node of Ranvier. Can you imagine that's faster? Absolutely. So we call this saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction is when you have a myelinated axon and that nerve impulse doesn't move uniformly, it skips down the axon. So we could do a little experiment in our mind. We could do it two different ways, but let's do it in an easy way. We could either run up the stairs or run down the stairs. What would you rather do? I would rather run down than run up. So let's run down the stairs, okay? And we'll do it two different ways. Let's run down the stairs, but the first way, you got to step on every stair, okay? You're going to step on every stair. That's like continuous conduction compared to the second way. You're running down the stairs, but now let's say you skip two stairs in between. So every fourth step you're stepping on, which is going to be faster? When you're skipping, right? Same thing for conduction. When it's a myelinated fiber by saltatory conduction, that increases the speed from about 2 miles an hour to 300 miles per hour. So that's why myelinated fibers are so much faster, because a nerve impulse or an action potential skips down an axon between these nodes of Ranvier. A huge difference. Okay, and we do call that saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction is due to these myelinated, these segments of myelination where there are no voltage-gated channels, so it just hops down from one node to another. Now, sometimes somebody has a demyelinating disease process in their brain. So what does that do to a person's brain? If their brain is developed so that it operates at a certain speed, and then all of a sudden you change the speed of one part of your brain without changing the speed of the other, then what? Signals kind of get lost and mixed up, right? And that's an autoimmune disease. We call that. Does anybody know what that demyelinating disease of central nervous system axons is called? Okay, the reason I'm asking because I forgot for a second, but I think I remembered. Okay, it's actually multiple sclerosis, okay? So there are plaques in the brain that form instead of these nice myelin sheaths, and then the timing of all these action potentials gets all messed up in a person's brain, and it gives them motor difficulty, gives them sensory difficulty, depends on what part of the brain is degenerating. Fortunately, right, people go into periods of remission where the myelin sheath is rebuilt, and that's really the point of medicine, is to elongate these periods of remission and to minimize the periods of activity where a lot of drugs are actually beneficial to people. Okay, so people can learn to manage multiple sclerosis with the help of various pharmaceutical agents. They can't be cured, but they can help manage their condition. So if you get a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, you still can enjoy your family and your children and things like that, but things will be different, okay? Some days will be better than others. Okay, synaptic transmission. So that's why we learn about all this stuff. Synaptic transmission. Anybody have a question about action potential or saltatory conduction, continuous conduction? Okay. I know you have to go home and study this stuff before you can even develop decent questions. Okay, a synapse. Synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And there's two kinds of synapses. There's a chemical synapse and electrical synapse. In order for information to move from one cell to another, if it's an electrical synapse, then there is a direct electrical connection between two cells. And it's due to a current, right, electrical current. And in your body, what can you use as an electrical current? Yeah, an ion, a movement of an ion from one cell into another. If an ion can move from one cell to another, it can change the electrical properties of the second cell. and that can be done with an electrical synapse. But most cells don't have a pathway for ions to move from one cell to another, and that's really a good thing. Right? It requires the transmission of a chemical signal. So the cell, the sending cell has to release a chemical, the receiving cell has to receive that signal by binding the chemical to a receptor. All right, so we call that a synapse. So the presynaptic cell is the sending cell. It releases a signaling compound. Sometimes we call that a neurotransmitter. The receiving cell has to have a receptor for that neurotransmitter. All right, and if all that is working properly, we call that synaptic transmission via a chemical synapse. Electrical synapses are pretty rare, all right, but they rule the day in your heart, for instance. Maybe I can talk about that. So here is an example of two cells. I see a nice phospholipid bilayer. So here is the top cell, here's the bottom cell. Pretty sloppy anatomic language, but it describes what we're looking at here, right? So they're two separate cells. And let's just say that we have sodium, a high level of sodium inside the top cell. Okay, that's not a stable state. Normally it would be low, but let's say this cell got excited where sodium entered the cell. When sodium enters, what does that cause in terms of your electrical terminology? When sodium enters a cell, that causes what? Depolarization, and that is? It's excitatory, right? So now we have excitation in the top cell. Under normal circumstances, that sodium ion cannot get through the phospholipid bilayer. Why is that? Because here's that hydrophobic region on the inside of that membrane. Sodium is a polar compound, can't get through. Certainly it can't get through the second cell membrane down here in the bottom cell. So sodium can't move from the top cell into the bottom cell, even though it's dying to get in there, because what's the concentration of sodium if this cell is at rest? It's very low, and the inside of the cell is also negative. So the electrical chemical gradient is trying to draw sodium into this particular cell on the bottom. Right. If the cells have gap junctions that are built by these connexin proteins, so there is a tunnel, this tunnel is always open. So if sodium gets to be high inside the top cell, it's going to excite the top cell, it's going to depolarize the top cell, and then what is sodium going to do for this bottom cell? It's going to run right through this gap junction into the second cell, causing depolarization or excitation in the bottom cell as well. And then if the cell next to it has gap junctions, guess what happens to the third, fourth, fifth cell down the line? It becomes depolarized and excited as well. All right, so your heart has gap junctions in it because the heart is designed to contract as a unit, okay? Not just one part of the heart. If one part were to contract, part of the heart were to contract, and then another part, all right, then the heart would just kind of push blood around inside the heart, but wouldn't pump blood through your body. It has to contract as a unit. So heart muscle has gap junctions in those intercalated discs. So all we have to do is excite one part of the heart, and eventually what's going to happen to the whole heart? It's going to be depolarized, be excited, and contract as a unit so that it pumps blood. Okay. Now, that wouldn't work really well for skeletal muscle, because if I were going to reach out and get a glass of water, if all my skeletal muscles had gap junctions, what would happen to all the skeletal muscles in my body? I go, oh, I'm thirsty. I really would like to have a drink. So I'd reach out, and what would happen? Your whole body would contract. And I would die of thirst if that were to happen, right? So would you. So the junction between neurons and muscle cells don't have electrical synapses. They have chemical synapses. So let's look at a chemical synapse. Okay. This particular synapse is going to be a junction between one neuron and another neuron, but you can also think of the neuromuscular junction, where this is a somatic motor neuron, and then this is the muscle cell down over here. Right? So it could be considered the same thing, because a synapse is just what? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells with two variations, either electrical or chemical synapse. And here is a chemical synapse between two neurons. Well, you know something about an action potential, right? It causes depolarization of the membrane. It can move along an axon. What do we call the motion of an action potential along an axon? That's a nerve impulse. Yeah, it's just a nerve impulse. And what kind of proteins in the membrane are responsible for producing that nerve impulse? Yeah, a sodium channel, but a specific kind of sodium channel. You know two kinds. You know, ligand-gated channel or voltage-gated channel. So in an axon, what kind of channel is that? It's a voltage-gated channel. I know you guys, I know you know it, you just don't want to say it because it's so weird, because you haven't thought about neurons being this electrical, but you have to start thinking about it, right? So an active potential is moving down this axon because of voltage-gated channels, which causes depolarization of this membrane. When it gets down to this terminal button, or Bouton terminale, the swelling at the end of an axon terminal, okay, there are other kinds of channels incorporated into the membrane. And these channels right here are calcium channels. So they're specific to allow calcium to transit. All right, and where do we find calcium at a high concentration? This is back from one of the previous chapters. Is it high inside or outside the cell? It's high outside the cell. It's almost zero inside the cell. So now we open up a channel for calcium, right, because Ca is calcium. All right, so we open up a channel. Calcium now rushes inside the cell, okay, as a result of that action potential reaching this terminal Bouton or terminal button. A lot of different ways people talk about it. So now we have a big rush of calcium inside the cell. That is, now that's an activating signal. Not only does it cause depolarization because it's a cation, right, but calcium is an important signaling compound. It binds to a molecule called calmodulin, and that's how it got its name, because it binds calcium, so C-A-L stands for calcium, and it modulates something. It modulates the activity of an enzyme inside the cell. Calmodulin only becomes activated after it binds calcium. So when the cell's at rest, there's no calcium inside the cell because guess what? There are calcium pumps everywhere along this membrane, right? So if there's no action potential, the cell is always pumping out calcium from the cytosol. That's why there's almost zero calcium in the cytosol under resting conditions. So here is an enzyme called protein kinase. Now what does a protein kinase do? It phosphorylates something, uses up some ATP when it does it, but it's going to phosphorylate something. When calmodulin is inactive, then protein kinase is inactive, but as soon as calcium enters the cell, calmodulin activates the protein kinase. It's going to run around inside the cell doing what? Phosphorylating some kind of protein, and when it phosphorylates a protein, it's going to change the conformation of that protein. And it might change it so into its proper configuration so it becomes active. So it's going to activate other kinds of regulatory proteins inside the cell, okay, as a result of calmodulin binding to it. And these regulatory proteins, once they're phosphorylated, because that's a kinase right here, will cause these vesicles, we call these synaptic vesicles, and inside these synaptic vesicles contains neurotransmitter, right? And you have a name on the tip of your tongue of any kind of neurotransmitter yet? Acetylcholine is a good one, okay? And we find that in the nervous system, but also in all neuromuscular junctions for skeletal muscle. So here is a synaptic vesicle containing neurotransmitter. When these regulatory proteins become activated, then these vesicles move over to the cell membrane, fuse to it, okay, dock to the cell membrane, and then by exocytosis, these neurotransmitters are released into the space between the cells that we call the synaptic cleft. Okay, so the fusion, the docking and fusion and exocytosis of neurotransmitter is due to an action potential reaching the axon terminus, but also allowing calcium to flood the cell. So if we were to inject calcium into this terminal button, even without an action potential, these vesicles would exocytose or secrete neurotransmitter. So this is what we call the presynaptic cell. Here's the presynaptic membrane. Here's the synaptic cleft, which is a space. And then this cell over here is what we call the postsynaptic cell. And here's the postsynaptic membrane right here. All right, so this is not an electrical synapse, because if the presynaptic cell was going to communicate with the postsynaptic cell through the synaptic cleft, there would have to be a lightning bolt moving across this synapse. And we just don't use lightning bolts in our body. Okay, we'd burn up if that were the case. So that's an impossibility. So this is an example of a chemical synapse, because what's moving from one cell to another? A neurotransmitter or some kind of what we call a ligand, because that's a small molecule compared to the molecule that it has to bind to over here. So this neurotransmitter can cause a physiologic change in the postsynaptic cell if the postsynaptic cell has what? It's got to have a receptor. It's got to have a binding site, which is complementary in shape to the neurotransmitter. All right? And that receptor is what we call a ligand-gated channel. All right, so it's not really showing on this illustration. Maybe on the next slide. No, but we talked about this already. You could actually draw in a receptor right here, which is going to change the electrical properties of the postsynaptic cell. All right, the amount of neurotransmitter that's released is due to the amount of calcium that enters the cell, which is due to the number of action potentials that reaches the axon terminus. So the higher the stimulus intensity, what can you tell me about the rate of action potentials reaching this axon terminus? If the stimulus intensity increases, the frequency of action potentials increases as well. Because of what? You would invoke frequency coding. So you got to know something about the relative refractory period of an action potential to see what's going on there. All right, and as more neurotransmitter is released, then that's going to stimulate the cell more. And if it's going to stimulate the cell more, what's going to happen to the membrane potential? It's going to depolarize more, because depolarization is what? An exciting event. It's an excitation event. Okay. All right, so I think we talked about this slide already. Opens those calcium channels. Calcium is driven in by electrochemical gradient. Triggers exocytosis because it binds to calmodulin. I want you to be familiar with calmodulin, right, which activates a protein kinase. So here is some physiology. I don't hear any clapping. I should hear clapping because finally in this class we get to talk about some physiology and not necessarily chemistry or physical chemistry, right? But physiology is due to what? All of this physical chemistry that we had to know about. Why do things move across the synapse? Because it's high concentration of neurotransmitter at the presynaptic membrane, low concentration at the postsynaptic membrane. All right, so chemistry really is fundamental to understanding some physiology. All right, so the neurotransmitter is a ligand. It diffuses across the cleft, binds to receptor proteins on the postsynaptic membrane, and it can open or close channels. Right, and what kind of channels? Ligand-gated channels, not voltage-gated channels, because the neurotransmitter is the ligand. And it's only going to change the state of that channel when it binds to the receptor. The receptor and the channel are all the same protein under most circumstances. We're going to see a couple examples where that's not necessarily so. All right, now here's something that's really fun. The event on a ligand-gated channel can be excitatory or it can be inhibitory, depending on the particular ligand-gated channel we're talking about. All right, if a ligand or neurotransmitter binds to a channel that causes depolarization, what is that? That's excitatory. How would you think of what kind of ion would be used to excite a cell if we open up a channel? Sodium. Yeah, because that's going to cause depolarization. So if a ligand binds to a channel and it opens a sodium channel, sodium is going to rush in the cell. That's depolarization. That is excitatory. Okay. But if a ligand binds to a potassium channel and a potassium channel opens up, guess what's going to happen? Potassium is going to leave the cell. When potassium leaves the cell, what does that produce? Does that produce depolarization? No, that produces hyperpolarization. What do you know about hyperpolarization? It's inhibiting because it's taking membrane potential which way? Farther from threshold, farther from threshold. So that particular ligand-gated channel would be inhibitory because it's producing an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Okay, so and I think I never want to say that again. I just want to say what? An IPSP. An IPSP causes hyperpolarization on what membrane? The postsynaptic membrane, because that's where that ligand channel is located. So, signals move in one direction across the synapse for a couple reasons. Number one, because only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter. The postsynaptic cell doesn't have neurotransmitter at this synapse. Okay? And then, so a signal can only go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell because the presynaptic cell is the only one that has neurotransmitter. But also, the postsynaptic cell is the only cell that has a receptor, right? And what parts of a neuron have receptors for ligands? Dendrites and cell body, that's why we call that the receiving end of a neuron, because it has ligand-gated channels, right? And an axon is the sending end of a neuron because it has voltage-gated channels on it. Okay, and so signals can't go retrograde from the postsynaptic cell to the presynaptic cell because the presynaptic cell does not have a receptor and the postsynaptic cell does not have neurotransmitter to release into the synaptic cleft. So signals not only move in one direction down a neuron, but also through a synapse, it's unidirectional, right? From one cell to another. Okay, so graded potentials. Remember, graded potentials have different amplitudes. Okay, it all depends on how much ligand binds to ligand-gated channels on a particular area of a cell membrane. And then after excitation or inhibition starts, that excitation dies away as it moves away from that point of excitation. I don't want to flip through the slides, but if anybody wants me to flip back to that original slide, the cable property of graded potentials, in your mind, maybe I'll go back really fast. If I can stop without getting too carried. Here's a graded potential. So let's open up a ligand-gated channel right here. And let's just say we're going to then put a bunch of positive signals inside the cell. What ion is moving in? Sodium that causes depolarization. That's excitatory event, right? Due to that ligand-gated channel, it's going to cause some depolarization. And that depolarization is going to flow through a dendrite or a cell body. But as it moves over distance, it dies away because of resistance inside the cell, right? So that is a nice graded potential. And if a sodium is entering the cell, that's excitatory because it's causing depolarization. What slide was I at? Right here. Okay, so EPSPs or excitatory postsynaptic potentials are due to sodium entering the cell. IPSPs or inhibitory postsynaptic potentials occur maybe a potassium gate is opening and allowing potassium to leave the cell, which hyperpolarizes the membrane. So EPSPs and IPSPs are not action potentials, these are graded potentials, and they can either be excitatory or inhibitory depending on what they do to the cell membrane. Right? And EPSPs, IPSPs are due to ligand-gated channels, not voltage-gated channels. And where do you have ligand-gated channels on your neurons? Dendrites and cell bodies, not axons, right? So it says right here, dendrite and nerve cell body only. GPs are variable in amplitude, you're aware of that. GPs propagate with what kind of activity? Decrement, they decrease over time. But the cool thing about graded potentials is that they can summate. Okay, they can summate. So for instance, if we have a graded potential on this dendrite at the same time as a graded potential over here, right, at the exact same time, graded potential number one, as it moves over this dendrite to the axon hillock, what's going to happen to it? It's going to die away, or it's going to decrease in amplitude. But if there are two on this dendrite and then also on this dendrite at the same time, they're both going to die away, but maybe by the time they reach this axon hillock, they can add together and still maintain a threshold voltage. So individually, an EPSP might be subthreshold, but if a number of them reach the axon hillock at the same time, they can summate, add together, and reach threshold. And then what happens on this axon here? Then you have an action potential that will move without decrement down an axon. So this axon hillock is pretty fascinating because it acts like an integration center. It can add information up from various parts of different locations on a neuron and then decide what to do on this. By the time it reaches this axon hillock, it can decide whether to send an action potential, yes or no, down the axon. So every neuron has the ability to make a decision in your body as to whether it should pass information on or not based on that threshold voltage. All right, so we're going to start talking about this next time, okay, right around in this region right here. So at least today you should know the difference between action potentials and graded potentials. They're due to different channels on the membrane, ligand-gated channels versus voltage-gated channels, and they're located on different parts of the neuron. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. I do want you to sign the sign-in sheet. If you didn't, make sure that you do. Hey, did any part of this lecture make sense? A little bit? Okay.
So the mechanical and the thermal, when we heated up on a glass rod.
Okay.
So the action potential was higher than the one.
Yeah, it's really confusing because an action potential is always the same. So an action potential is always the same. So maybe what you were looking at was a graded potential due to the stimulus of the heat and maybe the mechanical disruption of the membrane with the glass rod.
Okay. I'll try to find some
more. Yeah. Hi.
I just have a question in Blackboard. How come my grade's not updated? It's like
for which kinds of grade?
For
your
the
test?
I only put
your lecture test in there.
Oh,
but your online quizzes? Your online quizzes should upgrade as soon as you hit submit.
Like, my overall grade doesn't change, though. It's always A+. Even though I got, like, it only counts this grade.
Okay, so these are online quizzes here? Yep.
Yeah.
So that's being counted. What are these up over here that you have zeros by? Those are
the
extra credit. Okay, and lab quizzes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you know what? I didn't get any grades yet from an instructor.
But the lecture test is not counted either.
Maybe I don't have your lecture test for some reason. Can you see me right now? Do you have lab right now?
No, I don't.
In my office? Do you have like 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Because I need to find your test. What's your name?
Reina, R-E-I-N-N-A-H.
Maybe you put it in the wrong pile, or maybe you didn't put your name on the Scantron or something. Let's go find it right now. You know where my office is?
No.
265?
265. Okay.
Second floor. It's like the number of days in a year except on the second floor.
All right. I'll meet you there.
Okay. Hi.
How come the action potential can't summit if it's with the
reach? Because of the refractory period.
Oh, okay.
And once they reach a certain voltage, that inactivation gate closes, and they can't go any more positive because of that inactivation gate. Yeah. An activation date. Okay. Yeah. Sign-in sheet, anybody?
No.
Good.
Hi. I'm wondering if you're here on Mondays or Wednesdays.
I am, but you know what? I'm in class.
Oh, yeah.
All day long.
Oh, okay. Because I'm still kind of fuzzy with Chapter 5.
Okay.
But I do go to SI.
Yeah, you don't want to not go to SI.
Yeah.
Just talk with me. Let's see. Mondays. Yeah, usually maybe right at 3:40 if I get to my office before 4 o'clock.
Okay.
Okay, between 3:40 and 4, maybe we can talk for a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
On Mondays?
Yeah. Mondays and Wednesdays? Yeah, maybe Wednesdays would be a little bit better.
Okay.
Okay.
Perfect.
Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah, write your questions down.
Okay.
Good. Otherwise, you'll forget.
Right.
Yeah.
I took the online quiz
yesterday
and this morning.
Yeah.
And every time I take it, like, after, it usually tells me what I've gone wrong. But every time I do it, like, it's just like, blank.
Oh, maybe I didn't activate that feature
in
it to show you what your answer was.
Yeah. Because I did it on, like, 3 different browsers, and each time it was, like, different.
Oh, maybe I programmed these quizzes differently or something. I'll have to see.
Okay.
So it's not showing you your selected answers now, but it used to show you what you selected.
Yeah, like last week it would,
okay.
But then for this week, it didn't show
it. It just gives you the grade, but doesn't tell you what questions you got wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, that could be tough.
I'll write it down either way, just in case.
Yeah, I'll try to look at that programming.
Okay.
All
right, thank you.
Maybe tomorrow, but not tonight.
Okay.
Okay.
Can we only do the lecture test during your office hours, or do we know?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. Tuesdays, Thursdays, before class.
Before class?
Yeah.
So in between 8 a.m. lab and this
Let's see, I usually get in 8:45 till about 11:20.
Okay.
And sometimes I'm in the anatomy study room.
Okay.
Like from 9:30 to 10:30, I'm in the anatomy study room on the third floor.
Right when we get out of the lab.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Okay,
it's
cool.
Perfect.
All right.
Perfect, okay. Yeah.
Okay. We had a question.
Okay.
From the worship that John gave us, is this that the reducing agent donates electrons? Isn't that the oxidizing agent donate electrons?
Reducing agent donates electrons. Reducing agent can reduce another compound. A reducing agent can reduce one that is oxidized. I know it's tricky. But a reducing agent is an agent that can give away electrons. Okay, so let's say you're hungry. Let's just say that you're hungry for electrons.
Okay.
Okay. Are you oxidized or reduced if you're hungry for electrons?
if I need electrons?
Yes. If you need electrons, if you're hungry for them, you are oxidized. You're oxidized. And let's say I want to give away electrons.
Okay.
Okay, and I can give electrons away to you. What happens to you?
I get reduced.
You get reduced. Yeah. And I get oxidized, right?
Because so you need some now.
And now I can accept electrons. Okay. So I was the reducing agent. I was able to give you electrons and reduce you, but in the process of doing that, I went from reduced to oxidized. I know. It's just weird. But you just got to think about it in different ways with different analogies. Maybe that analogy helped you.
Okay.
But always go back to the basic principle. When you get electrons, you become reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And when I give away electrons, I become oxidized. So you just got to take your time and work through just every step just like that.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm honest with you, because we're here, reducing and reduces are different, right?
Reducing agent becomes oxidized after it reduces something. But a reducing agent's job is to reduce something.
Thank you.
It sort of sinks in after a while. It does sink in, right?
Oh, I took OCHEM.
Oh, after OCHEM it sunk in. Okay, yeah.
That's not good.
All right, thank you.
Clear as mud.
Yeah, right.
Just try to go back to the basic principle, and that is when something receives electrons, it becomes reduced.
Okay.
I know, people tell me I'm right all the time.
I try to use this.
Yeah. Let me check that out.
Like every color possible, but they all look the same.
They all like the same, I know.
I know they're different because they have different numbers.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I've never been able to figure it out except if I wore that one red contact lens.
Yeah. I went to my doctor and said, I can get you glasses like that.
Oh, really?
They're going to be really expensive and you can only have one color.
Right.
Well, can you make different colors on the same one so I can use them as bifocals? They don't do that.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. And there's no photometer that's really good either.
Yeah.
You know, like people that maintain pools and spas and things like that, you know, then they make some aftermarket colorimeters, but they don't really work very well. The human eyeball, yeah, pretty amazing. I think they used to be, but because of the nursing program, you can only have so many hours of prerequisites that they got erased away.
Yeah.
But it makes it harder on students. No two ways about it. Yeah, chemistry is fundamental to physiology. Just the way it goes. It does. If you take one before the other, it makes the other easier.
Yeah.
But it's best.
Now we talk about, you know, NAD and NAD.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
ATP.
Oh, yeah, we know NAD and FAD all day long. Going, huh? What? Hi. I am right now. 265. 265. Second floor.
265?
Yeah, 265. That's my office. Okay. It's like the number of days in a year, except on the second floor.